My balls are fucking massive.
Episode 17
of Look Radio.
Of season 4 of Look Radio.
Which is episode 17.
So on the show, we've got loads of stuff and we've got half of the actual Look Radio team.
We have, but we have two perfectly reasonable and adequate substitutes.
We have, we've got Chris Jones,
who works at Chronicle. Between them, have the right amount of hair for two people.
Oh! Yeah, Chris is, how shall we say it, losing it.
Sadly,
he
yes.
is.
Well, lost it.
I still got a little bit.
Your hair's going inwards and coming out your toes.
I still have some tufts.
It actually looks more bountiful than the last time I saw you in November.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's all about the cutting and the styling.
Right, okay.
So I literally have teams of people coming in
for more bounce and manageability.
Absolutely. Okay. And then we have Matt Lee, who looks like the Play-Doh mop top hair shop.
Yeah. Play-Doh mop top beard shop.
And Matt Lee from the GNU Project, or from the FSF, or
from
whatever.
From the GNU Project, yes.
Indeed. He's also got a reassuring stain on his t-shirt.
It does appear that you have masturbated furiously on your hacker t-shirt, which is not good. So Matt's here to talk for the FSF.
He is.
Yes. Sorry, Matt's not here to talk for the FSF.
Yes.
I got that wrong, didn't I?
You did, yeah. I'm here to talk about the GNU Project, about the FSF, but from my own perspective.
Yep. Yep. Okay, so on today's show, we have...
Matt.
That's me, yeah.
Yes.
Stuart
Langridge as well.
We're going to be giving Matt a royal beating about the FSF later. Yes, John Bacon, Stuart Langridge, Chris Jones, Chris P. Jones.
What the fuck?
Matt P. L.
What the fuck are we going to talk about? I've completely forgotten what we're going to talk about.
We're going to give Matt a beating about the FSF. All of our anger and frustration about the Free Software Foundation, how they're not doing the right things,
is going to
be poured
onto
Matt.
It's not only going to be discussion, it's going to be a legendary record beating discussion. It's the longest segment we've ever done. It's about 4.5 hours long.
Yep.
How do you know that? We haven't done it yet.
Well, anyway. What have those two hippie shits in the corner been doing? We're going to talk about what these two guys have been doing in the I've been mostly using segment as well.
And in a special guest appearance from Matt and Aide. This is Matt Revell, not Matt Lee.
Lazy bastards can only come in for one segment.
Yep, so we have an interview with Interversion Games. An interview with Introversion Games.
Who made
Defcon
and Uplink.
Uplink.
And
the other one, Darwinia.
The other one that we don't care about.
No, Uplink's good.
Uplink's good.
Defcon would be good if it didn't do one frame every 30 seconds on my unaccelerated computer.
Hang on a second, Uplink looks good. Have you actually managed to do anything with it?
I tell you what, right? Uplink, I thought I'd better have a crack at this. Downloaded it, didn't understand it, and then spent some time working through the tutorial. And it was really interesting. I mean, I haven't even finished the demo yet. I don't know why you'd buy the game.
I often think to myself, if you need a tutorial for a fucking game, then there's better things to be doing.
Well, yeah, but it's not a game like Max Payne. You know, it's a game like chess, for which you ought to at least read the rule book.
Yep. So what you want to do is...
It's not the most obvious of games, really.
Yep.
So Uplink, you can get that from PlayStation3.com.
Can you actually?
Of course you fucking can't.
I thought, well, you know, you were rattling on about them doing good games, downloadable and so on.
No, but credit where credit's due. Those guys do an incredible job.
They do. Defcon's great fun.
And
we're not talking about the PlayStation 3 still.
No. They're doing a pretty decent job as well, but you'd expect that.
And we're going to talk to Chris P. Jones about what it is to be a sysadmin.
Sysadmin. And of course, we've got a bumper selection of emails.
We've picked up some emails.
So let's get on with it.
Since we have Matt Lee on the show, we ought to talk about the Free Software Foundation, or the Open Source Foundation, or whatever they're called.
Free Software Foundation.
Fucking stupid foundation.
tell us why people should give a shit about the FSF.
Why people should give a shit about the FSF?
No. Didn't you add your time now?
Why should people give a shit on the FSF?
tell us why. I mean, do you feel like the FSF is representative? What do you actually do for them?
I don't work for the FSF. I work for the GNU Project.
What's the difference?
The GNU Project, it's like Canonical and Ubuntu, so the FSF sponsor the GNU Project.
Non-free? I'm here.
A huge commitment to freedom. That's right. Yeah. So,
yeah.
They've all got ridiculous beards and smell funny.
Actually, we have very few beards.
We do have very few beards. In Canonical.
Jono has one of the most impressive beards going.
Thank you.
Just generally, or
Chris has got an incredible anal beard.
I'm just too lazy to shave. That's the problem.
FSF.
Yeah. So the GNU project is one of the things the FSF does. The other thing we do with GPLv3 process. Defective by design. Those are our main projects at the moment. So,
okay.
The GNU project is one of those.
Three things.
One of three things at the moment. There are more than three things. There's
whining and complaining.
The free software directory as well.
Isn't there Savannah? Is that a GNU thing?
Savannah is a GNU. Yeah, it's like SourceForge.
Is that a GNU thing or is it an FSF thing?
It's a GNU thing.
All right. Okay.
It's a bit confusing, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it is.
What's the point in having the distinction? I mean, I'll be honest with you. Jono mentioned Canonical and Ubuntu, and I still don't really understand the distinction between the two things anyway. Is there any point in having a distinction between the FSF and the GNU projects? And if you go to fsf.org, it just takes you to GNU.org, doesn't it?
Not anymore. Now, that's been changed quite a while now. Now, if you go to GNU.org, you get the lovely website that I made.
So I look at the FSF website regularly, as you can tell.
You look at fucking meatspin.com.
I look at the FSF website in its 1980s glory regularly.
But that's not true anymore. That's what I was brought in to do. So
really?
Look at it now in your browser.
Really?
Yeah. You'll see that.
Okay, let me look at it right now. Hang on.
Yeah. So John is looking at
now. Tell us what you've been doing then.
So, in the last couple of years, I've been making the GNU project website look very pretty and building it up to be quite a good website. FSF.org now is actually a clone site, which is run by the FSF itself. And it contains all the stuff about the FSF and the process for defining the new GPL and stuff like that.
Right, okay. Why clone?
Why clone? Plone is free software.
I know Plone is free software.
Okay.
I'm only kidding.
It's very brown.
So, yeah, we're
That looks very different to the default plane thing.
Mr. Bacon has the FSF.org website.
Just kidding.
Presumably you had Helen Keller on board as design consultant.
I didn't do this. If you look at GNU.org, that's what I did.
Oh, right, okay. Oh,
come on, Jono.
That was a bit unfortunate. We're giving you a shoe for something you didn't do there. This is going to be like this really pretty glowy thing, like the Windows Vista website. Well,
that's not bad, actually. That's pretty decent.
Yeah, that's not too bad. Okay.
Of course, Mr. Langridge here has got no fucking right to contribute any discussion about quality of design and websites.
I completely agree with you.
He's disgusting travesty that is cryogenics.org.
But all the links work. all the links do work, and it's easy to read.
Nice.
And that's all
text.
I give a shit about. Anyway, moving on.
Yes.
With built-in screen reading.
Why do we care about what the FSF are doing?
So the FSF really sits there nowadays as a kind of overall leader for the free software community and shut up.
It's not a leader of the free software community.
Hang on, let the man
speak.
Okay,
sorry, carry on and then
so, we can kick him in the knackers in a minute.
The goal of the FSF is to promote the concept of free software, and the role of the FSF these days is to promote not just the GNU project, but also things that relate to free software and freedom in general. So DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, the new version of the GPL, things like that. So the FSF really relies on the people in the community to donate money to do these projects and get involved with things. And there's a lot of, it's entirely member funded.
Right, okay. A question then.
Yes.
Based on the sneering when you said that the FSF were leaders of the free software community. Do you think that the open source community is a very big thing with most of the people in it and the free software community is quite small, but the FSF lead it?
I don't really know what the open source community is.
Stop channeling RMS! I don't understand the term open source.
No.
So I've got a business thing I'm not involved with.
I know what the term open source means. I know who the OSI are. But there's no... In the same way that the FSF has the GNU project, what does the OSI have in comparison to that?
Hang on a second. The FSF has the GNU project. So the FSF is like the Canonical. The GNU project is like the Ubuntu, basically, the way this thing works out, right? Okay. Sorry, I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
What makes you think that a community needs a leader?
I don't think a community needs a leader, but I think a community
needs... The whole point of the open source process is kind of everybody shares together. There's not one guy who runs the thing, is there?
Yeah.
It works successfully where you have a benevolent dictator, in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of benevolent dictator things, but there are... communities that don't work like that. Why can't the open source community be one of those without
the whole thing about community?
An identified leader?
The whole thing about community is that some communities don't need leaders. So, for example, throughout the KDE 2.x series, they didn't really have a leader. People created KDE2 without a leader. Now with KDE4, you've kind of got people like Aaron Saigo's, who's not directly a leader, but he's really inspiring people. And then with the GNOME project, you've got people who are leading in different capacities. And then you've got very distinctive leaders in other projects, such as Linux. I don't think that there's necessarily needs to be a leader.
It's not so much a leader in the idea of like one person. It's more the idea of an organisation that's there to kind of to benefit the free software community in general. So I see.
Those two things are entirely different.
I mean,
the way you're talking about the FSF there is they act like SPI do to the Debian.
Yeah,
project.
Exactly.
They sit back and they help the community through altruism. But from my perception of the FSF, they're not interested in just helping. They're interested in running it.
In running
the free software community. If you're part of the free software community, you're doing it the FSF's way.
Well, the FSF founded the free software movement.
I agree with you entirely. Yeah. But doesn't necessarily get to run it forever.
Free software existed before the Free Software Foundation. Really, what Stallman was doing was returning software to freedom.
Yeah.
Because it started free.
That's
and then became
academic debate, though.
Well, okay.
And in Chris's defense, I mean, it's free software existed beforehand, but what Stallman did is Stallman essentially labeled it.
Well, he created a movement.
The concept of having free software, we're going to call free software, we're going to call the GNU project and things like that.
Well, prior to proprietary software, there was just software.
Yeah.
And that software was free software.
But does that mean that just because Led Zeppelin founded metal years ago that we should constantly be following those just because they had one achievement?
Sorry, who
are
Led Zeppelin?
Ago.
Thought it was Iron Maiden.
Nah, well, this is a whole this is a whole different debate.
Lug Radio discusses who founded metal.
Let's park that one. Okay.
Lug Radio founded heavy. No,
Iron Maiden is
heavy metal.
Well, oh, let's
not. We're not doing this.
I don't agree. So the FSF provides.
The FSF defined the free software concept as a movement.
Yes.
I'd concede.
We all agree
that,
yeah.
And there's the pivotal document, which is the FSF, the free software definition on the GNU project website, which is, you know, the following concept of what is free software.
Right.
Free software has those four freedoms, which is useful.
Just before we go a bit further, then, if you'd have asked me to define a pivotal document.
Yes.
And we weren't talking about licenses, so I wouldn't say the GPL. It would have been the OSI's open source definition.
Why?
From the Debian Free Software Guidelines. I didn't even know the FSF had a definition of free software document.
I didn't either.
Really? Okay.
Freedoms. If you'd have said to me, define what's the document that defines what free software is, I'd have said the Debian Free Software Guidelines.
Is that like the four directives in RoboCop?
I thought there were
only three. Uphold
the law. Yeah. The fourth one's classified.
I thought the third one was classified.
That's a good point. No, it's the fourth one that's classified.
Ah! I shouldn't be proud of that, should I?
First of all, you should be proud. Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten a minor detail about a film I watched once 20 years ago.
You can shut the fuck
anyway,
up.
Anyway, moving on. RoboCop knowledge, boy.
Transformers is coming.
Shut up about shut up about the Transformers film.
No one cares
about the Transformers film.
Yes, it is!
We're talking about the FSF.
Goddamn children's movies.
I'm watching them transform into the OSI.
Transformers, generally.
Apparently Optimus Prime has lips.
Does he? I can't believe. Shut up, we're not talking about the bloody Transformers film. Right, so
I don't want to ask the next question.
That's basically my problem with the FSF. That they see yourselves as having a right to run to define what free software is in perpetuity.
I didn't think there's a right or a perceived right there. Essentially, we have a definition of free software.
Yeah.
And free software, as defined by the FSF and the GNU project, is a certain thing. But there are other definitions of free software. As you mentioned, there's the Debian Free Software Guidelines. There's the OSI's guidelines for what is, quote, open source software.
The thing is, though, is that in terms of the FSF, I mean, one thing you said earlier on was kind of like leading the free software community. If that's kind of what the FSF, not necessarily is doing, but hopes to do, I'd say that they're doing a pretty ropey job of it.
I think it's what the FSF should be doing.
But I don't
more
see in my mind, it's exactly what we were saying earlier on. Is that one of the greatest things about free software is the fact that people do things their own way. People have got choice, and there's kind of perceived good practice in the fact that, for example, you know, people have bug tracking systems and people have open mailing lists and an open IRC channels and things like that. There's these kind of practices.
And we have all of those.
You know, there's practices in place, but no one owns, no single body recommends and suggests the way things should work. Every project is different. Every project works different. And the concept of having a single project to do that, to me, seems a bit funny. But then, going on from that, if the FSF think that's what they're doing and think that's what they're actually managing to achieve, I wouldn't say that they are achieving that at all.
That's what I think the FSF is doing.
Right.
Do you think it's what they are doing or what you like to see them do?
I'd like to see the FSF do a lot more.
Do you feel part of the FSF? So I'm referring to, I'm saying, do you think that's what the FSF should be doing? Should I be saying that's what you should be doing?
I'm not part of the FSF. I'm part of the GNU project, so...
Who are part of the FSF?
Yeah, surely it's like, it's like, it's like me saying, I'm part of Ubuntu, but I'm not part of... You know, I'm part of Canonical, but I'm not part of Ubuntu.
See, I think it's possible to be part of Ubuntu and not part of Canonical.
Absolutely.
Sure, it is. But to me, it's like... part of the reason for that is Canonical is a commercial company.
It's an employer.
Commercial employer. Canonical basically choose who can be part of them, right?
Whereas, as does the FSF.
Right,
the FSF has employees.
Right, okay.
And an office.
But surely the
staff.
FSF... Isn't the FSF an open organisation as well? So surely anybody
open
can...
in what sense?
In the sense that surely people can be part of the FSF. Surely the people who are employed by the FSF is one aspect of it, but...
You can become a member of the FSF.
If you join the FSF, do you get anything other than, you know, a card and the fact that you've donated some money and therefore you feel good
about
it?
You're not a voting member.
You don't get to contribute to the direction of the FSF?
Not at all.
Right, okay.
Not formally, not legally. I mean, you get to go along to the associate meetings, you get to be part of the members' community online. But you don't get to say so-and-so should become the new director
right,
of the FSF.
So when the FSF makes decisions, it's done by the employees of the FSF, not by the members.
And the board of directors, yeah.
Yeah, but not by the members.
It seems to me that the major benefit of people such as Richard Stallman and obviously Eben Mugland and the FSF and GNU is mainly in... Obviously, in my mind, is the legality of free software, the licensing of free software, and ensuring that those rights and legalities are defended.
Sure.
To me, the concept of the FSF butting in on how people run their communities or how the open source community, or, sorry, free software community as a whole, kind of moves forward, seems crazy because
I don't think the FSF is butting in on that.
I'd say that the FSF, the fact that, you know, I mean, it may have been your own statement about sort of leading the free software community, but to me it's like the FSF are there largely to make sure that the GPL is there.
The FSF is also a large copyright holder of a lot of free software.
Right.
So a lot of the software in your typical GNU plus Linux distribution is owned by the FSF.
But
FSF has a right and a responsibility to protect
right.
that free software.
So again, this is kind of like in terms of the legality and the licensing of free software. And to me, it's like if the FSF and the GNU project is based around that aspect of free software community and free software, that's great. The problem, I think, is when we get into arguments over branding and arguments over trademarks and things like that and the concept of leading the free software community. Because in my mind, the free software community has got to the place where it is now more because people have done it their own way and not because the FSF have done anything in particular other than the GPL. And the GPL has made pretty much all of this possible,
largely, in my mind. The role of the FSF as a leader is about, you know, taking... We have lots of GPL v2 code out there. And we're defining the GPL version 3 at the moment. And now we're looking at, you know, the next steps, taking free software forward into the next 15 years.
Right.
And I think the FSF has a fairly pivotal role in that.
So other than defining the GPL 3, and other than...
Defective by design.
How is the FSF doing that? What are the big campaigns that the FSF is working on to
right.
take free software forward into the future?
So we have Defective by Design, which is the campaign against DRM.
That was founded by the FSF?
Yes.
Right, okay.
DefectiveByDesign.org, which is the website where you can go along and get involved with...
They're pretty cool, Defective by Design.
Yeah, and you've got the cool hazmat suits.
They're going to protest the hazmat suit thing. Yeah. Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
And there's BadVista.org, which is the campaign against Windows Vista.
I mean,
we can talk about that, Johnny.
That's a FUD campaign.
It's not a FUD campaign.
It is.
Why isn't it?
Well,
it's exactly a FUD campaign.
While I kind of, you know, generally sympathise with the goal of the thing, you know, Microsoft did that thing where they had typical Linux users... And how to,
I didn't see that.
There's all five. I can't remember the
it's fairly recent
name.
Was
LinuxFacts.org or something.
LinuxFacts. And then recently they had the Linux user personality.
Yeah, the Linux user personality.
That's right. I mean,
to my mind, Bad Vista is just the other side of the coin from that. They're both FUD campaigns, basically.
Well, the point of Bad Vista is more that Vista is out there now, and Vista is getting a lot of press, and it's about, you know, giving another side to the story about Vista, showing what Vista does in return in respect to taking away the freedoms of computer users.
I agree with the underlying goals of the campaign, but the Linux Facts thing, Microsoft would say exactly the same thing about
that
it's trying to show the other side of the coin from all the good press that Linux gets.
Yeah, they're showing that there's value in proprietary software. There's value in purchasing a product from a single vendor and what you get from that and things like that. It's FUD on both sides.
You might disagree with their goal, and you might disagree with their viewpoint, which is fine. You have a perfect right to do so. But I'm not seeing that Bad Vista is fundamentally different from the Linux Facts thing.
Well, I mean, Bad Vista is about partly about going out on the internet and collating information from other sources. So other websites talk about Vista or the problems with Vista or DRM issues relating to Vista or.
But it seems to me that this is one of the. This is to me in my mind is one of the criticisms that I level towards the FSF is that. There's too much focus on what I consider relatively insignificant things. I mean, this is a big deal for us.
Okay.
You know, definitely a big deal. It's a great thing for us in many ways because with Vista coming out, it means that people are reconsidering their IT decisions. It's a new purchasing time for a lot of people.
Yes.
Right? So it's an opportunity for open source, for free software and Linux and everything. I'm trying not to say open source because I basically mean free software.
Free software, yeah.
But the thing is that in my mind, we need to stop smearing Vista.
We need to not look like shouty, childish kids.
Yeah. And it's in the same way that shouting and bawling about...
non-childish kids, I know.
Shouting and bawling about GNU/Linux and shouting and bawling about Bad Vista and things like that, to me, is taking effort away from a generic campaign to basically say, this is what free software's about. It's got nothing specific to do with this brand, it's got nothing to do with this distro or this operating system that our competitors have got, but the concept and the goal of free software, without it coming across as a mighty ethical mission, you know.
That's the role of GNU.org. GNU.org, I mean, you talk about the shouty. We don't really shout about GNU/Linux or GNU+Linux, whatever you want to call it.
Mr. Stallman has shouted quite a bit about that, hasn't he?
If you interview Richard and you talk about...
We can't interview Richard because he won't come on the show.
He won't come on the frickin' show.
Because he insists we refer to Linux as GNU/Linux and we call ourselves Glug Radio. Otherwise, he won't come on the show.
He probably insists that you refer to the Linux kernel as Linux, and you refer to the operating system as a whole as something other than Linux.
How is that not shouty in the same way? I mean, I don't want to get into the whole Sun provided more code than GNU argument.
That's Richard, and that's not the FSF, though.
Really?
Oh, come on. That's Bill Gates and that's not Microsoft.
The two things are pretty closely identified.
Pretty damn late. That's not Ubuntu, that's Mark Shuttleworth. I mean, there's a connection there.
There's a connection there, certainly. But if you look at the website, GNU.org, you find that you know the amount of information they're shouting at you for not referring to things correctly is actually not there.
Can
at all.
You think of anything, any substantive view at all in which the Free Software Foundation and Richard Stallman differ? I mean, you'd know about this. You're on the inside.
Okay. So Richard's not paid by the FSF. He's the director of the FSF, but he's not. He's not, you know, paid by them. He, you know, works by... He's a, what's the phrase I'm looking for here? He's not paid member
Free
of staff.
Freeloader.
Tax dodger.
No, sorry, that was a very unfair phrase, Rose, because he's doing the absolute opposite of freeloading. He's doing work without being paid.
Yeah. So he's a volunteer, you know. Yeah.
Idiot.
I wouldn't say he's an idiot.
I'm joking. Okay.
A touch unfair.
No, I mean... So, yeah,
Richard's views do not necessarily always represent those of the FSF, I would say. I mean, the FSF is more than one person. And the GNU project is everybody involved with the GNU project. Everyone's committing code to the GNU project. And, you know...
But it's weird because when you look at...
Before you go on, you're talking here about the GNU project as embodying all the GNU software, the entire GNU software suite.
Yes.
Because that's an entirely different thing from the GNU project you were talking about earlier, who represent parts of the free software community and so on.
That's the FSF.
You said that's what GNU.org was for.
GNU.org talks about the idea of the general concept of free software.
Well, yeah, but that's two entirely different roles. You've got representing the concept of free software, and you've got custodians of the GNU software.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, the GNU project started out to create the operating system GNU. So there are a lot of GNUs involved here.
Yeah.
So there's GNU and there's GNU and there's GNU. So yeah, it's a bit confusingly named. So there's the GNU project, GNU.org. Okay, and one of the things that the GNU.org project is doing is the GNU operating system, which now most people use with the Linux kernel, which is GNU/GNU/Linux.
So earlier on you said that GNU.org is there to push out the message of the generic message of free software.
That's where we have
But surely that's the free software definition.
But surely
that's the homepage for GNU as the organization.
GNU is the project.
So the GNU project. Yeah, no, but I'm saying that you've got the GNU project, right?
GNU, yes.
And GNU.org.
GNU.
GNU.org is the homepage for the GNU project.
Yes.
GNU.org isn't specifically there to talk about the concept of free software. That's the homepage of the free, of the GNU project. But yes. You're saying is that the way you guys push out the concept of free software is the four free software definitions. So do you believe
the one definition?
Sorry, the one definition, but it's got four bits to it.
The four freedoms.
The four freedoms. So do you believe that the one definition and the four freedoms is enough to tell people in the world why they should be using free software and not using proprietary software?
That's not the only thing we have on there. That's one document. So.
That's like saying, do the Americans believe that just the Constitution all by itself is enough to embody Americanness?
No.
Which they don't.
No,
but if you said, give me something that represents Americanness, they say the Constitution. No, it's got a representative, but it's not the whole story.
Something that represents the GNU project or the free software community. The free software definition.
From what Matt said earlier on, it sounded like what you were saying was that the GNU.org is there to tell people about free software.
It is.
Whereas it's not there to tell people about free software. It's to tell people about the Constitution. In the same way that you can talk about democracy by putting the American Constitution on a website, but to really understand the different aspects of that democracy, you really need a full site that explains all of the details and all
that's
the specifics.
What we have.
Right, and where's that?
GNU.org.
Right, okay.
So GNU.org. if you go to GNU.org, okay, you will see. It tells you about the GNU operating system, and there's a whole lot of software on there you can download, the GNU software. Right. But there's also a whole chunk, a whole philosophy directory on the site, which is just articles after articles after articles about free software, and issues that relate to free software. So issues that relate to DRM, issues that relate to users' freedom, issues that relate to patent law.
It's weird because, I mean, my own personal view is, I think the Free Software Foundation is very important, and I think the GPL particularly...
Do you give us money?
No, I don't.
Okay.
But I give my money elsewhere.
Okay,
right?
It's fine.
Don't fucking start.
Do you contribute to the Open Rights Group?
Fuck off.
Give them a
fiver. So you still haven't given them any money?
I did say I'd give them a fiver too and didn't bother.
Right, anyway.
My monthly fiver went out yesterday.
Great. But in my mind, the FSF's very important.
Yes.
The GNU project's very important. I think people, like I said to you the other night, I think people like you, in many ways, are more important to the FSF and the GNU project, in many ways, than Richard Stallman is. Because you're out on the ground, you're coming on Lug Radio, you're fielding the questions, you're talking to people about this. Even though you say you're not officially part of things, you know.
I'm not officially part of the FSF.
You're not officially part of the FSF.
Officially part of the GNU
but
project.
You're a strong contributor to the project. And to me, that's a real and strong and valid contribution. I think, in my mind, the only thing is that I think the FSF have got and the GNU project has got their heart in the right place, which is about free software, and the GPL is all very important and everything. But to me, it's just going about it the wrong way.
Okay, so I guess the question I would ask you then would be, how can we do things better? What would you like us to? What would you like us to do? You're a member of a community. You run a community, Ubuntu.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're a big part of the free software community.
Yep.
And some proprietary stuff we won't mention. But what would you like us to do better?
He's about to say, stop saying stuff like that.
Well, that's one thing. I mean,
stop doing proprietary software then.
In a way, we are. Because there will be from the next version of Ubuntu, a version without all of the bits you guys don't like.
You may be talking about Launchpad.
I'm not talking about Launchpad.
Launchpad's anyway. Canonical anyway, not Ubuntu.
It's very confusing, isn't it?
Anyway, going back to the question, the man
has asked for opinions.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I'd like to see is the FSF as a body who've got some money behind them and the GNU project as kind of like the project.
Yes.
I'd like to see that collection of people have the kind of put out the kind of message and the kind of impact on the world about free software that Apple do with the iPod.
Okay.
I'd like to see a big, glossy campaign that boils all of the concepts down into things that people actually understand, things that people actually affect people. Because the big problem in my mind with the FSF, the big problem with the GNU project is that a lot of it's very theoretical if you're already somebody who's very hardcore about computers. Whereas I'd like to see the message be tuned towards people such as my dad and people such as people who run small businesses and people and things like that. So that's one aspect of it. It's like essentially a marketing campaign that's glossy, that's suited towards the audience. And the second thing is to really concentrate on the wider picture. I mean, I've got a lot of respect for the organization, but like I said, the GNU/Linux thing to me sounded just childish.
Can I respond to that one first? Okay, so I'll take the GNU/Linux one first, okay, because it's one we get all the time, and I think it's worth just quickly kind of putting that to one side for a second and explaining it. So the name GNU/Linux, I prefer the term GNU with Linux myself, because, you know, the slash is a horrible thing to say. It doesn't sound good. You say slash to somebody, it sounds weird.
Right, okay.
So
unless they're Spock and Kirk, obviously.
Yes. I don't even get that joke, but I'm disagreeing with you on this one.
Slash fiction.
But it wouldn't. The name wouldn't matter. Okay, if the goal was over, if we had a completely free operating system, okay, the name wouldn't matter at all. But the thing is, we don't have that. We still have areas.
Yes, we do.
We don't.
Name it.
GNU Sense.
Completely free.
Yeah.
Okay. Runs on any hardware, you can just stick anything in there, but it works.
Whether it works or not is not the point. It's a completely free operating system.
Strikes me as being a little bit of the point.
Yeah, the power of an operating system is to operate, surely.
But the point is that we have got a completely free operating system. You could run GNUSense on some hardware, and it would work perfectly well.
Yes, you can.
To some extent, that's chasing a goal down a rabbit hole, though, in that even if you can guarantee that you're going to have free drivers for everything, you're not necessarily going to be able to guarantee that you've got free BIOSes for everything, so you'll go after that. And so after that, you're going to ask for free microcode for every process. And then you're going to ask for open VLSI designs for every chip.
Yeah. I'm all in favour of all of those things being free and open. As a free extra bonus in response to your response, I believe if we had that completely free operating system, the FSF would insist we called it the GNU operating system. I never mentioned the word Linux at all.
I don't think they would, because, credit where credit's due, Linux is a part of the GNU plus Linux operating system.
Well, yeah, but so is
GNU.
So's Bash.
Bash. Bash
is a bad example, because it's part of the GNU project, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So is the X-Window system.
X-Window is also part of the GNU project.
X.org certainly is not part of the GNU project.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't.
If you look at the initial announcements of the GNU operating system itself, Richard says there are certain things we're going to take on board initially. One of those is X.Windows. One of those is tech. Two things that were already there.
Are you talking about X.org today?
Yes.
Right?
It's part of the GNU system.
It's not part of the GNU project.
It's not part.
But it's part of the GNU system.
Oh, there's a lot of names. Again, there's a lot of GNUs here. You know.
Right. So.
So there is the GNU project, okay, aiming to create a free operating system.
I understand your point of saying it's part of the GNU operating system. Fine, but it's all. But the Ubuntu people have declared that it's part of the Ubuntu operating system. So you don't get to complain that they're not calling it GNU/Linux, because they've decided it's part of the Ubuntu system.
If Ubuntu wants to go out there and say, hey, we're Ubuntu, and this is the Ubuntu operating system, okay? Yeah. I'd have a problem with that. I don't think the FSF have a problem with that. The GNU have a problem with that at all, okay?
Lies.
If you go out there and say, this is the Linux operating system, then we're going to say to you, hang on a second, that's not the Linux operating system.
But why does it matter? If you're saying one system's Ubuntu, if you've got a problem with the system being referred to as Linux, surely you'd have and it's not referenced in the GNU aspect, surely you'd have the same problem if that same operating system is referred to as Ubuntu.
Ubuntu's a brand name.
Linux is just a description.
Why can't Linux be a brand name?
Linux,
well, it has been a brand name.
Linux is two things. It's a brand name and it's the name of the kernel. Yes. In the same way that GNU is the name of the project and the operating system.
Yes.
Mm. Right? The problem
Linux is a brand.
Yes, it's a registered
trademark.
That does not refer to freedom, though. So people hear the word Linux, okay?
Ubuntu doesn't refer to freedom either.
That's true. People hear the word Linux and they think of open source software. They think of people like Eric Raymond. People who do not push, I believe, a message that is appropriate to free software. The message of open source software is different from the message of free software.
Yes.
And if we want people to create free software and to continue and to value their freedom, okay, there's an intrinsic value in referring to GNU. People haven't heard of GNU. And if you mention to them, this is the GNU system, they might check out the GNU project website.
I can see that. That's
understand better what free software is over and above what open source software is.
So it's not necessarily that it should be called GNU/Linux because there's lots of GNU code in it.
That would be fair to...
It's a trackback.
It's fair to refer to something
it's a trackback. That's a good analogy.
Yeah,
it's a trackback to the GNU project.
So you're basically saying that because the GNU project talk about free software in what you define as free software, therefore you guys are the only fucking people who can brand a piece of free software.
No.
Basically, the Ubuntu project or the Fedora project or the Debian project cannot do that. Only the GNU project can do that.
No.
Because the Debian project can't possibly say, we talk about free software, and in the same way that the Ubuntu project talk about free software. It sounds awfully like that. It sounds like you're saying that you should call it the GNU system, because then people will think, oh, I'll check out what this GNU thing is, and then they find out about free software.
Debian's a very good... I mean, Debian have the Debian free software guidelines as an example.
And Debian is called Debian GNU/Linux.
I know, but if they called it Debian Linux and said, we are the arbiters of freedom, and people would look at that, and if they didn't know about free software, if they called it Ubuntu Debian, right, because it's based on Debian...
That'd be a great name.
If they called it Ubuntu Debian, it would encourage people to learn about Debian and the principles that underlie Debian.
Yes.
And things like the Debian Free Software Guidelines.
Yes,
and,
it would.
And you'd have no problem with that.
That would be a good step.
A beard. fucking enormous chin.
I reckon if you were to take an exact copy of the GNU project and call it the Bacon Project, and something was called Bacon/Linux or Bacon,
GNU
project. the GNU project would still complain about
what,
it.
What, you clone GNU, call it Bacon,
yeah,
and refer to things as Bacon/Linux,
or just refer to it as Bacon.
Brilliant, do it.
And you think the GNU project would be happy?
Love it.
Really? But even if they're unhappy, there's nothing they can do about it. That's entirely within your rights. There is a lighthouse of morality. They're an unmoving moral message which you can choose to ignore. You can choose how close you want to go to.
I like the fact that there's someone representing that aspect of the software mentality. I think it's good. I love the fact that we have flag bearers. Basically, you need someone to refer to.
Yeah.
I mean, to answer your question, what do you think that the FSF should do? I think what you've done with Defective by Design is brilliant.
Thank you.
Because Defective by Design is getting the message out and it's helping, but at no point are you basically stopping people in the street who have an iPod and bollocking them for having DRM music.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think we've ever bollocked anyone for having a laptop with proprietary software in it, though.
Beard! Oh,
when
come
did
on.
You last see someone get stopped in the street with, hey, you've got a Windows laptop?
You've bollocked me repeatedly for running proprietary software.
Yeah, and I've been bollocked repeatedly for running proprietary software.
By who?
You!
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, I mean, I can do it. It's fine.
The whole point about Defective by Design is that you said we want to educate people in what we believe they're doing wrong. We want to illustrate to them the advantages with doing it
and
our way
really
rather
well.
Than their way. And it has gone down really well, and it's been really successful, but it's not a polemic. It's not a panegyric against people who are using DRM music. You've said, okay, people are using DRM music. We must educate them, not we must hex them.
So we should do another sort of Defective by Design type site for free software in general.
I think so.
But this is exactly what I was saying. Is that what you need?
Defective by Design approach more than a site. Okay.
What happened with Defective by Design is that this thing came out. It was exciting. It was new. It was different. It was sending out the right message. It was fresh. And the thing is it came out and it had a big impact. And that's exactly what the FSF should be doing. But all the FSF seems to do, in the eyes of me,
is
basically bollock people and basically bang on about a legacy. And we need to have new, fresh thinking going on there. And then the FSF will be really, really relevant.
Did that. I mean, they invented the term open source and everything, and there was this whole rebranding thing going. Whether you agree with what they did, you can't deny that they brought a fresh approach to things, and that approach has been quite successful. But now that approach is done. I mean, it's out there, people know about the term, that's it. So I like Jonas says, I'd love to see the FSF do something like Defective by Design, new and fresh, and educate people about what they need to know as we start to get Linux right in the hands of people who are unaware of the debate, of the freedom debate. We need to start educating them about it.
Okay. Yeah. Then the only thing I could say to that really is we need money to do these things. Give us money.
Sure, but the thing is as well is that, I mean, if there's one thing the FSF should do in my mind is hire a marketing department, hire a PR firm.
Actually, we've just put a job advert on the website for a campaigns manager.
Right, but the thing is, I think what you need is you need an image, you need a brand, you need you need something that people can cling on to. And the Defective by Design thing in many ways did that. Like the concept, the thing with the hazmat suits was brilliant.
Fantastic.
It was brilliant. And that's exactly the kind of thing we need to see.
I had no idea it was actually an FSF project.
The
FSF have gone up two or three notches in my estimation just because they did that.
Should I try and get a hazmat suit for Love Radio Live?
That would be superb.
That'd be fucking tremendous.
Do that.
I'll do that.
Once again, the canonical invasion happens. Less of the wrapping up the segment. Chris Jones, obviously, Chris works at Canonical, and he's a sysadmin who is a monkey.
Thanks, Johnny.
With a lead. So we thought it would be interesting to talk about just sysadmins in general, not just at Canonical. Chris came up earlier today and I was talking to him. And one thing that always fascinated me about, has always fascinated me about sysadmins is the fact that there seems to be this huge amount of information that you need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were talking about plumbing in electrical systems and then setting up racks and you're having to and you were making firewall rules and you were doing all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, where the fuck do you learn all this kind of stuff? I mean, it's fascinating.
There does seem to be a lot more skill to it than just being a software hacker.
Yeah, usually.
So where do you begin on, like, where did you begin?
Most people, I would say, either begin by teaching themselves or working at an ISP. Those are the two main routes into it. And in my case, the two are combined in that I started at an ISP working on the help desk and at the same time was starting to play around with Linux. And
built yourself a lot of racks in your bedroom, did you?
No, that kind of stuff.
Oh, another 19-inch rack that I need for my other 4U servers.
Nice rack.
No, I mean, of course, you do think, oh, wow, wouldn't it be great to have a rack in the room? But then you think, wait a minute, that means having fans and ACs and UPSs, and it gets a little bit crazy.
Anyone who thinks that is clearly born to be a sadman. I've never thought, wouldn't it be great to have a rack in my room?
Well, then I guess
rack
I probably
ribs, possibly.
Then I guess I rack, probably was born for it, maybe.
Try not to make a rack joke.
It's so difficult.
Once you start getting some basic ideas down, you can get a job as a junior sysadmin, which really, I mean, John, I was taking the piss there a little, but really it is monkey work, and you're ferrying cables around and plugging machines into servers and stuff.
Crawling under desks and plugging in network cables.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
Stuff.
And you'll be in a small company doing support for 5-10 people. And that teaches you so much about what it actually means to be a sysadmin, which is effectively, in most cases, to take ownership of all of the technical systems of an organization.
Now, obviously, obviously, Canonical's a Linux distributor.
Yeah.
And other things. And the thing with Canonical, as with every other distributor, is that, you know, we shift an awful lot of CD images, mm-hmm. You know, when we release, and just as a general rule. Mm-hmm. So there must be, like, a lot of machines to look after. There must be a shitload of bandwidth to deal with, a shitload of concurrent users and things like that. Is it a big deal? I mean, I understand you don't want to say figures, but is that a big deal? And B, Does that freak you out a little bit that you've got so much responsibility?
Do you feel like you've got large balls every time you do the download figure?
Well, you feel a real sysadmin when you see those download figures.
I mean, obviously there are networks bigger than ours. There are people with a lot more systems than us. But I would say we are disproportionately well equipped for our size as a company.
So Canonical, Ubuntu, disproportionately well endowed. Nice, that's the new strapline. What's going on Ubuntu.com?
I mean, simply because we are a software company, and every 6 months we want to give each of our users another 700 meg of data. I mean, so that places some pretty heavy requirements. You can't just, you know, rent a website from somebody and stick it up for £25 a month and
so
be done with it.
Our website probably wouldn't cut it, do you think, Hack?
I don't think so, to be honest with you. Best story I ever heard about that, I was talking to the guy who does the Comic Relief website, mm-hmm. And he was saying it's setting it up's a nightmare, because, you know, their bandwidth goes nought,
infinity.
100 million people an hour. And how do you test it?
There are plenty of machine programs you can use to produce high load on a web server. There are some which will literally just repeatedly hammer the same page over and over again, and so you can see how quickly you can scale static content or whatever.
What, like wget or something?
I mean, wget in a tight loop doesn't really help. There's one that comes with Apache called Apache Bench, which you just give it a URL, you tell it, I want to do, you know, 1,000 current connections, go and get me the page 5,000 times.
Wicked.
And it will just hit it like crazy and give you an answer.
We must point that at lugradio.org, see what happens.
If
listen carefully, you can hear the explosion.
One try mark first, yeah.
But that gives you a very unrealistic figure, because you're not going to get people hitting the same page over and over again.
Sure, yeah.
Thousands of people at a time. So there are some more advanced tools, Siege, which has gone a bit crazy recently, but you can give that a whole list of URLs, and so it'll go off and hit them. And you can
do this kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, to some extent, it's very difficult to simulate real world load.
But do you sometimes go to work? Because it's kind of like, it seems to me like it's kind of like working in a museum where you've got the keys to all of the fucking really expensive mm-hmm. cabinets and tripping over something or knocking something over.
Yeah.
You know, you're surrounded by so much responsibility.
Yeah.
That if Ubuntu.com goes down,
that does instantly start to affect people. And every time you restart an Apache or change a firewall, you've really got to be paying a lot of attention to what you're doing. In a company, if you restart a firewall and somebody loses their email for 5 minutes, they're going to complain at you and move on, and that'll be it. If we start kicking off, I mean, every time you restart Apache, if you have to do a full restart, you're kicking off anyone who's connected. And if you start doing that to people a lot, that's going to annoy them. So, yeah, you have to consider that quite a lot. And one of the other interesting things there is that we don't have time zones to protect us. If you're working in an office in a company,
just do it out of hours.
You wait till 6 o'clock and you do anything you like. We don't have that.
So do you find the other thing which I've thought about sysadmins is that it sounds like for small places, if you're the only sysadmin, it's relatively easy because it's just you and you know everything that's going on. You can control what's going on at certain times. But when you've got a big infrastructure and you've got lots of sysadmins, how do you sync these different people together?
I was going to say, do you have to have lots of documented processes?
Yes.
No one must restart Apache without first alerting the other three and getting permission off of X and change request forms and that kind of
thing. You do have to keep very close track of what people are doing. So if you come across a machine that's broken or not working, the first thing you can do is go back and look at the logs for that machine and see what has somebody done to it. What are the recent things people have done that might have caused it? Might be related, it might not be. You need to be communicating well. The teams need to be talking to each other, and a lot of teams in the company do peer review processes. So before you make a change to some code or to a configuration or something, somebody has had a look at it and said, no, what are you doing? That's bollocks.
Yeah.
So these reviews of like changing one line in a HTTPD configuration file or something like that.
Obviously common sense can apply.
But there's quite a lot of structure and process and review around what the sort of thing that I would consider to be a simple change. You just do it, and if it doesn't work, then you experiment again.
Exactly. I mean, from my own personal kind of learning to do it myself, machine in the corner of my bedroom, if you break it, doesn't matter. You can just, you know, take half a day to bring the machine back up. And in a small company, that's still true. But the more complex your systems become, the more people depend on them, the more you have to really pay attention to this. I, for example, I know someone who works for a bank, and he will literally take days to make the tiniest of changes because it has to be signed off by so many people.
I can imagine,
If he makes a mistake and gets it wrong,
it's one major motherfucking
fuck-up. That's people's money disappearing straight away.
I'm terribly sorry. The system was down for 60 seconds. That only cost the bank $4.8 billion.
How do you deal with things like you get a new release out there of Ubuntu, and you've got all these people, you know, it gets on the website, hey, you know, Feisty, whatever is out now, go and download it. And suddenly you get all these people come along, downloading things off the website.
Yeah.
How do you make bloody sure that they're not downloading something that's, you know, been corrupted in some way or has not been tampered with? You know, because if you give a file out to people, you give out a new kernel to, you know, your user base, and suddenly it's got a problem with it. So how the hell do you make sure that doesn't
occur? I mean, there are lots of things you can do with that, and that problem is exacerbated by the fact that we have so many mirrors, that we produce a package of something and then dozens of sites all around the world will take a copy of that, and if one of them corrupts it somehow, then that's all of their users having problems. But there are things you can do with that, like, for example, rsync will very quickly tell you if a file is identical to another file. So if you just run a little test rsync against a remote server and yours, you can tell that the two are the same. And of course, all of the packages have MD5 sums. So
I could say worse than package corruption is deliberate malicious package fucking about with you. You know,
absolutely.
If you say Ubuntu has got 500 million users, you've presumably got to be careful that you don't push out a new kernel to someone with an exploitable root hole in it.
Absolutely. And that's why the packages get signed by, you know, the build demons when they build them. Compile it for the end user, they cryptographically sign it.
Exploitable root hole. Is that an actual term?
It's not a video.
It's not a million miles from wrong.
A root hole?
Yeah.
Okay. The thing is, what you, Chris, I mean, you as Chris, just speaking yourself, what do you get? Do you get a kick out of the fact that you get to geek around with all of this technology, or is it the fact that you've got a big engine, you know?
Well, obviously I get a kick out of the fact that I've got a big engine. I mean, yeah. Who wouldn't?
Fucking right.
It's a combination of things. Yeah, I mean, I do enjoy playing with technical systems, and so it is great to get to go and play with some of the best systems available. There's also an aspect of it of allowing people to do their work. Because obviously the sysadmin team, we don't produce anything that's part of Ubuntu.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't write any public-facing documents or anything like that. What we're doing is enabling the rest of the company to do their work.
Yeah.
And so that's quite nice that it's you know, the better you do your job, the less people know you even exist.
And not only the company, but you're supporting a huge community of people who, or like you say, all around the world. I never even thought of the time zones thing. Of course, you know, it's you've got to be always ticking, haven't you?
Are all of your servers running Ubuntu server?
Yes, I think they are. I'm just trying to think. I can't think of anything that is.
It's interesting as well because
it'd be highly amusing to find some of them running Edge.
No.
It's interesting as well that Chris's boss, James Troop, is one of the funniest people I've ever met.
He is, but a comedy legend.
But he is also one of the angriest people I've ever met. And it must be quite interesting when he fucking gets pissed off.
I've always been a big fan of the angry humour that Bill Hicks is.
He's so funny. I mean, it's like when I've been down to the office, I've been sat there, and he'll just sit there, and the office will be quiet, everyone's working away, and then all you'll hear from the corner is this, "You motherfucker!" It's kind of like something's gone wrong.
I obviously can't confirm or deny such allegations, but...
He cracks me up.
I think...
Performance review coming up. I think
do you think your boss is an angry bastard?
I have to say, honestly, I think all of the sysadmins I've ever worked with at random points will just swear viciously at their computer.
Yeah. Sitting there in a boff t-shirt. Yeah.
I am indeed wearing a boff t-shirt.
So, yeah. And the only other thing I was going to say is, you know, everything's running on free software, is it? Or do you have any proprietary systems that you have to use?
Launchpad.
If you look at Launchpad, it is running on free software.
Okay.
It may not itself be entirely free software, but that's...
And actually, of course...
As I understand it, Windows uses the BSD TCP/IP stack as well, so that's fine too.
Well, there we go. So all credit to them for not rewriting that.
We're not...
Making a horror show of it.
Rewritten for Vista, we're not fighting about Launchpad again anyway. I'm bored of
it. I really am bored of it. And that's not even here to be bored of it. It's just so pissed off with it.
You do have a distinct problem when you start building really fast networks where you've got to join lots of machines at high bandwidth together, that you have to start talking to vendors of networking gear who aren't necessarily open about what runs on their machines.
Do you have situations where if you want to use some hardware, because we've got, you know, a distro team, do you get any of the distro hackers to make specific kernel builds or do any hacks to make it work for the sysadmin?
You think you'd have the best tuned Ubuntu systems in the world?
I think we probably may well do, but I wouldn't necessarily... I mean, obviously the distro team make that possible by the virtue they make the distro, but we don't really want to take away too much of their time making our system slightly better for us.
Yeah.
That's our job. If we find bugs, of course, we feed it back to them. But, I mean, we can't, you know, go and bang on someone's door and say, you will fix this for me now.
It's mad because I remember being at All Hands, the Canonical conference, and Christina, who was doing marketing at Canonical until recently, she had some kernel problems. And she's like, I don't know what this problem is. And it's like, well, Ben Collins is sat over there.
Yeah, there's a guy who works on the kernel, so go and ask him.
So Ben came over and fixed it on her machine. And it's kind of like, I was doing a talk last night.
Keep back up.
I was doing a talk in Brazil, and my fucking laptop wouldn't work with the projector. And who stood next to me? Keith Packard from the X project.
You can't ask for more, really, can
exactly.
you?
Exactly.
And could he fix it?
No.
And there it is.
So, but yeah, it sounds like a fascinating... I mean, I know that you think it's fascinating.
Have you got like a sysadmin weblog or something where you keep... Because every now and again, I'll read things about it and they'll
say... That shit's fascinating.
It is. It's written... It's not fascinating because I actually need this information. Same way that I find reading people writing about poker really interesting. I don't understand half the words... But you get the sense that someone's standing there fighting this fight all day. And you think, well, that's cool.
It's the West Wing of weblogs. It's kind of like, you don't understand what the fuck's going on, but it's fascinating anyway.
Yeah.
I don't actually know of any really prominent sysadminery blogs. I don't really tend
from ASR, which doesn't really count because it's more, you know, confident. Yeah.
Knowing Chris as well is that Chris has a fundamental hatred of blogs.
I do. I don't care what you had for breakfast this morning.
Don't worry about that.
Whether you got up and...
Write about what you had to tweak to make, you know...
Yeah, then you could say...
The network totally stuff work. I don't care about what you had for breakfast either.
I mean, there could certainly be
you totally blog it. That's what you need to say.
I totally blagged it.
I'll tell you what. I wouldn't bother. I'll just go for fucking Twitter if I was you.
Oh, good.
Ooh, fuck Twitter. A bunch of Twitter.
Web 20.
Jeez. I mean, I can see that there would be a certainly an advantage in sharing best practice. And there's a very good series of articles, the perfect setup of this, the perfect Debian setup, the perfect XIM setup, whatever. And they've done a lot of work to distill the best practice.
Hey, that'd be really useful. A working XIM setup wouldn't hurt for me.
Hey, I tell you what, are you thinking we could fix those fucking XIM problems on our machine?
We haven't got XIM anymore, we've got PostFix. I don't understand XIM.
I was going to say, the reason why we haven't got XIM, because We don't fucking get it.
We don't.
At all. We don't get email whatsoever.
I think we've now moved all the email off the box and onto Gmail.
Because we just don't fucking understand
because
how
it works. Because we hate freedom and don't understand XIM.
To be fair, XIM is a fairly complicated configuration
easy,
language.
Is it?
But I mean, if you do put the effort in, especially the access control lists it does, right, that gives you some seriously powerful features.
Already miles above my head at this point. I mean, so if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, I really like the idea of being a sysadmin and being able to walk into my server room and see all the flashing lights and think, wow, yeah, I'm the fucking cool guy. What should they do?
The first thing they should do would be to find a spare computer, get a copy of a Linux distribution, and start making themselves web servers, mail servers, DNS servers.
Just play with
these things.
Yeah.
I mean, you may find that you have a small project, like radio, for example, where you need to run a website. Instead of contracting that out to somebody else or paying for some cheap, crappy hosting, have a go at doing it yourself.
I think I should try and convince my dog to take up being a sysadmin.
Having met your dogs,
whining.
I'm not sure that's a good idea.
Incidentally, Chris tried to kill my dogs earlier on by leaving fags on the sorry for our American listeners, cigarettes on the couch.
I was under the impression that your dogs were trying to actually look cool like Chris and I do by smoking.
It's true. Oh, at least 30% cooler.
But, roll on July.
That's the thing is that people who smoke do look cool.
Yes, we do.
Big lying campaign about you don't look cool if you smoke.
Wrong.
Yes, you fucking
you do. You do.
Admittedly, you get
smoking
cancer.
Smoking makes you look cool.
Smoking does make you look
until
cool.
Until you die at 53. You know?
Well, yeah, but
you might die at 54.
But you die cool. Would you rather be James Dean or Anne Widdecombe? Right, Anne Widdecombe has caused more fucking misery than emphysema.
That's a vicious charge.
Anne Widdecombe has caused more vicious damage than emphysema.
Smoking makes you look cool. Remember where you heard it first, children.
Okay, in the show now we've got John Alfred Nottenbelt from Introversion Games.
Introversion Games?
Oh, hi, how are you doing?
Not so bad, how's things?
Yeah, pretty good. Just been working on DEFCON Linux at the moment.
Fantastic. Excellent.
That's what we want to hear.
Should be coming out soon with a bit of luck.
That's what we like to hear. Now, obviously, we've got you on the show because we're interested in the fact that you're supporting Linux as an operating system and everything. So what kind of thought processes did you go through to make sure that you have Linux support?
Well, from the beginning, you know, we started off with the Uplink game. And we decided, it started off life as a Windows game, and our first platform to support was Linux. And this was because Uplink was written in university, and, you know, at our particular university, there were a lot of Linux machines around, and it was a very easy one to do. And one of the nice things about supporting Linux is, you go through a certain love of Linux, you just want to control everything, configure it exactly right.
Yeah.
And once you've gotten into Linux, then you just want to bring all your games to it as well. And so that's how we started. I was working with Chris DeLay, who had just finished writing Uplink, and I said, right, it's got to run on Linux, and he agreed. And then we started selling Uplink, and of course, most of the games were sold for Windows. But I think that people really did appreciate that we had brought it to Linux. And they, when they discover this, they sort of tell their friends. And it's good economically, I think, because you get some kind of underground advertising as people say, hey, you know, these guys support Linux, you know, you should go and visit their site. And, you know, they may or may not play it under Linux. But it's good. It's good PR, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, do you have in terms of sales figures and whatnot? Do you find that there are plenty of Linux people buying it? Is it as many as Windows people?
Oh no!
Are there like 9 Linux guys who buy your games and then that's it?
It's more than 9. It's absolutely more than 9.
Is it 11?
No. This sort of surprised me. I think when we had a look at this last. And that was after having done Darwinia for Linux as well. I think we, I don't have the exact figures to hand, but I think that we concluded that it was somewhere between 1% and 5%.
Right. Okay.
of
what we expected.
Yeah, of Windows users. And that's actually worthwhile to do.
Yeah. From our point of view, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not... It doesn't cost that much to do a Linux port. And, you know, if
how many games
many
have you guys done there?
Sorry?
How many games have you guys done there?
So this is, DEFCON is our third and most recent game.
And all of them are going to be on Linux, are they? Is that a decision?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah?
Uplink's on Linux. Darwinia's been out on Linux for some time now.
And does it take much extra work to make it work on Linux?
Well, you see, here's the thing. So what we do is we also port to macOS.
Ah,
now,
I see.
Now, with Uplink, it was a bit of an exception. But for Darwinia and for DEFCON, the macOS figures are much higher than than Linux. I'm not sure exactly what they are, but commercially it makes a lot more sense to do a macOS port.
Right, right.
So that's the first motivation. And then after the, because macOS X is all Unix underneath, and we use toolkits like SDL to help us do the porting. And you can get SDL, which is graphics and audio abstraction, yeah. Right? You can get that for Linux too. Well, it started out life with Linux, and then it came to macOS and Windows and all sorts of other platforms, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's not that much harder.
Good.
There are just some... I would say it's actually probably easier to port to Linux than it is to port to macOS.
Wow, that's surprising.
But
excellent.
On the other hand, there are some gotchas.
Pray tell.
Right, I do tell. You can't just say there are some gotchas and then be quiet.
Well, one of the nice things about macOS is that Apple control the hardware very tightly,
yeah, yeah.
And there's only really one distribution of macOS.
Yeah.
But with Linux, of course, there are many, many different hardware and software combinations.
Sure.
You've got all these different distributions and, all the PC hardware. And then you have also people running it in 64-bit capacities and, on PowerPC.
Yeah.
Well, or with multi-monitors and everything,
Gotcha.
So in that sense, it's a lot harder than macOS, but fundamentally the code is very, very similar.
Right. Okay. I'm going to bitch slightly now. I mean, I've played Uplink and I've played DEFCON, both of them as demos.
Right.
I haven't bought the actual games because I'm cheap. But I enjoyed playing the Uplink demo. That was fine. DEFCON seemed absolutely fine in the demo, but it was dead slow. And,
yeah.
My question then is. Is it because it needs 3D acceleration, which I haven't got?
Oh, I see.
And my question then is, if it needs 3D acceleration, why? Because it's just like blue lines on a screen.
Do you need more than 2 megabytes of RAM?
It's just blue
lines on a screen.
It is. I mean, Elite just had lines. That was in 1983, I don't understand.
Yeah, but it uses OpenGL behind the scenes to render it. In the lobby, for example, that's a sphere that's rendered in 3D.
Right, okay.
I think on Windows and Mac and also Linux, it's not that hard to configure your computer to do accelerated 3D, is it?
It's
unless
not that,
you're a punk.
Yeah, no, see, unfortunately, I'm one of the people who'd rather use the free drivers than use the proprietary drivers. So your opinion is now going to be, well, then, that's just tough shit. That's what you've got coming to you, isn't it?
Remember, you're 1% of
this
sales.
This is fair play. I mean, 1% of your sales, and I'm already complaining about it, so I won't ask too many nasty questions.
Well, one of the interesting things is some of the Linux distributions are getting a lot easier to use now. When I started off, it was always a long exercise learning how to configure your X11 configuration file, figuring out what DRI driver and DRM this and, the next thing, and getting your install of the... if you've got an ATI or NVIDIA card, then usually it's best to go and get the
proprietary drivers,
the binary-only drivers, and install them, and
like
all
explodes.
That, and what a mission all that is. But I installed Ubuntu Edge recently, and that did not take long to configure at all.
No, it's the distro of the gods.
Yeah, it's really good.
And us.
God runs Ubuntu.
I work for Canonical, by the way. Disclaimer.
And you're not a lawyer.
The question I was going to ask, when I first got into computing, it was a case of buying... So I've got someone doing taking the piss here, doing the Hovis music. Yeah, when I got into computing back with my ZX81, it was a case of going down to the local shop, maybe WH Smith, and paying $1.99 for a cassette of a game that some bloke had written in his bedroom.
Right.
In the age of multi-million pound studio games, where does that leave guys like you?
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, we are only a small company, and we have grown very slowly indeed. We started out with, really, Chris writing most of Uplink, and then joining, Mark and Tom joined, and, you know, it's been 5 years now for us to grow to, I don't know, about seven people.
Okay.
So we're growing very slowly. But what we try to do is to try make really stylistic games, you know. Things, Uplink was, there weren't very many, I can't think of one, you know, hacking games out at that time. And that was a good concept that people seemed to enjoy.
Yeah, we love war games.
It's still selling, Uplink.
Fantastic.
Now, in terms of competing against these multi-million dollar games, well, we can't do that. We can't follow the same approach as what they are doing in terms of generating these games that require these very detailed content, you know, lots of very exquisite 3D models and hundreds of levels and so on and so forth, you know, because we don't have the money for that.
Right.
Can't hire, you know, 30 graphic and so on. And well, we just take that as the design constraint for the game, really. You know, we can't do it, so how can we use that to our advantage? You know,
right.
If you take Darwinia, for example. Have you played Darwinia?
No.
Not Darwinia.
Well, played Uplink and
Right. Well, Darwinia has got if you have a look at the screenshots of Darwinia on our website, what you'll find is it looks like the cover of a magazine from maybe the Spectrum days.
Yay, crush.
You know, when you would buy a game and it would have this really great, you know, so-called screenshot on the cover of the magazine or on the cover of the box, right? You know, with these landscapes and things. But that wouldn't actually be what the Spectrum game renders.
Like a Roger Dean painting.
Right, the Darwinia looks like what it ought to have looked like.
Yeah.
Cool. Spectrum.
Excellent.
Kind of thing.
So
it has very low detail 3D models in it, and it all fits into the kind of retro theme.
Yeah.
So it's all, you know, stylized in this way. And DEF CON was supposed to give you echoes of a general in his bunker, right? He's all the way buried in his bunker, and he's conducting his nuclear war.
Right.
He's looking at some kind of radar screen, which is why it's all line graphics.
Well, as I throw a drumstick on the floor, I've got two final questions before we wrap up. The first one is... we've talked a lot in the past about encouraging more games, not only from the open source community, but from, you know, from commercial vendors as well.
Right.
So the first question is, what do you think the open source community can do to make Linux a more hospitable gaming platform, to make it easier for you guys to do your jobs and to bring out games on Linux
them.
And to sell them as well?
Buy some.
It's a tricky thing. I think from a technical perspective, the chaps at AutoPackage are doing a good job to help
excellent.
With that. Because with AutoPackage you can compile up binaries that have as few dependencies as possible on other, you know, on glibc symbols and all that kind of thing. So, and that works really very much appreciated. I think one of the things that is really difficult about Linux is it evolves at quite a rapid pace. Right. And, you know, you can put out your game 1 year, and then 2 years later, the fundamental glibc version will have changed.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, you'll be in for some more work, which is a bit tricky.
So it revs a bit too quick.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it just comes with the territory, really.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what could be done better. I think that's just the nature of Linux.
So do you think that, a lot of Linux people will vote with their feet, they'll buy Linux games to show their support and things like that. Do you think that is, does that actually have an effect?
Yeah, I think so. I think people do that, absolutely.
Right.
So
if people buy more games, you think that people such as yourselves are going to be more likely to make games?
Yeah, they certainly say they do this. You know, they say, hey, you guys, you're supporting Linux, or I'll buy the game, or, you know, I'll wait until the Linux version comes out before I buy it.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to tell, you know, just looking at, when an order comes through and it's for DEFCON, because we bundle both the... If you buy the Windows version, you get the Linux version for free.
Right, okay.
You see, so same with Darwinia.
Oh, right, I see. And my second question was going to be, when can we see a day when you can go into, game or... Woolies or PC World or something, and buy one of your games and pick it up off the shelf and buy it?
Well, we have been with Uplink and Darwinia. They were in shelves at one at one spot.
Cool.
At one time.
Fantastic.
And I think they go into the stores and they have their time on the shelf.
Magazine
and
then, covers. That's what you need.
They go out again. It's quite difficult competing in the PC world.
Yeah.
I mean, in the PC games arena for retail.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of shelf space.
Right.
For PC games, there's all the consoles, console games, and so you've got maybe three or four shelves, and one of them will be for the latest releases, and then all the rest will be just the mush. PC games.
Yeah.
Can you
see yourself branching out into the console world?
It's definitely something we're very interested in.
Right.
I think Darwinia would be a good game to bring to the console.
Yeah.
And I would like to do that very much. Just Fantastic. A question of
Excellent. Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah,
and we should also inform our listeners as well that I think I'm not sure if it's going to be you and the other guy the version are going to be speaking at Lug Radio Live as well.
Can we get a URL?
So
that's right. Yeah.
And where can
myself and Mark?
Fantastic.
Hopefully.
Excellent.
Super.
And where can we find out more information about the games and the company?
Best spot to go to is our website, which is www.introversion.co.uk.
Fantastic. So listeners, go and buy their games, show your support for Linux, and thanks for coming on the show.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This week, the new people are mostly playing with what? Bits of software. Stuff
two that, blank faces.
Two blank faces. My cock. bits of software that you've play with recently that you thought were cool. Matthew P. Lee.
Matthew P. Lee. I tried out the Beta 2 or whatever it is of Fire Thunder version 2.
Fire Thunder.
Fire Thunderbird.
Is that like Ice Weasel?
It was actually, Thunderbird 2. And it's got this...
it is Go.
Yeah, is it Thunderbird 5, Thunderbird 4? Thunderbird
2, Argo,
F-A-B. Right, so Thunderbird 2.
Thunderbird 2, yeah. It's got, the main thing that was being touted was integration with, calendars and stuff. So if you don't like Evolution, you can kind of use Thunderbird 2 as your email client to replace
calendars, services?
CalDAV stuff, and also Google Calendar.
Nice.
So if you're using Google Calendar.
So they've written something to the GData API.
Excellent.
No, it uses the XML repositories you can pass over.
So do you do that? Do you use that non-free Google backend?
I don't use non-free software. No, I don't use Google Calendar.
I use the magnificently non-free Google Calendar.
I haven't got a calendar, which is the problem. I need a calendar.
It's because so you believe in freedom.
I believe in freedom.
And freedom haters don't have calendars.
Well, I've got a paper calendar, but I haven't got a computer calendar, which is a bit annoying.
I'll tell you what, it's portable and it never runs out of battery.
This is true.
Oh, God. I came over to my place last night and we were just nattering and had a couple of drinks.
I'd love how this comes from fucking batteries.
And he was banging on about this fucking calendar. I'm amazed you haven't banged on about your fucking calendar.
Oh.
And incidentally, we're not going to bang on about your fucking calendar.
See, let's continue doing so. So what else is good about the Thunderbird 2?
It crashed instantly after that.
That's great. Lots of tags. That's a really good thing about it.
It's following in the tradition of Mozilla Thunderbird, then, which is why I don't use it.
The one thing I don't get about Thunderbird is the fact that extensions are just done so badly in it, in that in Firefox, you go to add-ons and you click on an extensions link, it pops up a browser, and you pick it out and install it into your browser. But for Thunderbird, you click on that link in Firefox. Sorry, I'm getting confused now. And it just goes, oh, it's an XPI file. Do you want to install it in Firefox? Which is, of course, absolutely useless to you.
Yeah, that's a bollocks.
It is.
Yeah. So, bollocks.
Like, get another file extension or something, guys. But, figure that out.
Mm. Or have Firefox be able to recognize that this XPI isn't a Firefox extension. Just do something.
And hand it off to Thunderbird.
Thunderbird people, write in and tell us that we're wrong again.
Yeah.
I bet you they'll say, oh, you can drag the link out of Firefox and drop it on Thunderbird or something.
All
like
you
that.
Need to do is type in XP
about colon config.
Z, Y, Z
about,
config.
About colon XP install colon and then cut and paste the URL into the address bar and then put !jar.thunderbird.
Yeah. So when I wasn't playing with that, I tried to use Planner, which is a calendar for Emacs. And didn't get on well with that.
Sorry. A very tiny part of me died just then.
Which part was that?
I was going to say, do you feel your soul shrivel a small amount every time you say the word Emacs? Right, so you played with the calendar for Emacs.
Cool Planner, yeah, and started using that. And that saves its stuff in a kind of fairly standard sort of text file. So you can do other things with it and edit it and stuff. But I need to find some way of using email. I use my email in Thunderbird now. I've gone from Mutt to Thunderbird, and I need to find some way of doing calendars.
Mm. I just read it all on the web these days.
Yeah. But where, though?
I did a big migration of all of my mail to IMAP, all of my contacts to LDAP, and all of my calendaring to iCal files.
Yeah, that's because you like the idea of running a server, and I fucking hate the idea of running a server.
It was mostly so I could use a web-based thing if I was away from my machines, but still have all of my mail synced to all of my individual machines and all of my contacts and all of my machines. And the one thing I discovered is that it's almost impossible to do. There is nothing that works properly with IMAP and LDAP and iCal.
Oh, that's a shame, isn't
Wasn't
it?
Wasn't Hula meant to do that at some point?
Before Hula. It was cancelled. Hula was more about the server end, I think.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
What's Hula called now?
It's
called No Such Project.
It's called Novell Doesn't Care About Us Anymore because they love the Microsoft.
Goodbye.
And incidentally, just so we have the because obviously Aid's not here, and at this point I should
Zimbra.
I should go Zimbra.
Should pimp the Zimbra world.
I love Apple TV. Zimbra.
Well, Zimbra does become a slightly more realistic opportunity. There is now an evolution.
What the fuck
connector
is Zimbra anyway?
Zimbra. It's an online Ajax email.
It's basically like Hula. It's very similar to Hula in the concept.
Yeah. It's Hulu, except they've built a decent web client for it as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Christoph.
So,
hello.
Christopher.
What have you been OR mostly playing with this week?
The thing that's mostly been tickling my fancy has been Asterisk.
Really?
The,
excellent.
The glorious open source.
So what have you been doing with it then?
Making a phone system, surprisingly.
Stunning. You fucking surprise me every step of the way.
Who do you call on your phone system?
The other phones to make sure they work.
You're calling yourself.
So you're one of these people, like the first guy ever to buy a video phone.
Which was Jerry Beadle.
Has this been for the office or has this been just in your home?
This has been a largely work project. Although, to be honest, I'm impressed with enough that I would seriously consider using it myself.
Excellent.
Mostly because it gives you just complete freedom. You can do whatever you like. A call comes in and you say, I want that call to go over to this phone or to these 10 phones or to these 8 phones
it's
in order.
It's pretty wicked, isn't it? I'll play with Asterisk for a while.
Can you use it to record telephone calls? So, like, if you're doing a podcast over the phone, you could use it for that.
Yes. You can have it set up so it will match against the tones it makes when you press one of the buttons on your phone during a call. So you could have the star button start recording a call.
Kicks it off.
While you're on.
It's awesome. I mean,
it really is.
How do you get started with it then?
You install Trixbox. That's what you do.
Well, yeah.
You don't go the hardcore configuration route like him. God, I'm glad Aid's not here.
You can indeed. There are several of them. There's Trixbox. I think Digium, the people who sponsor a lot of the Asterisk work, have one of their own.
Oh, really?
Free PBX, maybe. I'm
hang
not
on,
sure
so
which these way
are basically distributions of Asterisk.
Yeah. It's so, an Asterisk in a box. Asterisk. Please, yeah. It's asterisk. It's not asterisk.
Yes.
I don't understand why this... Asterisk is a dictionary word. Asterisk is a fictional fucking character.
So,
you're on a sore nerve here, aren't
we? Yes. Trixbox is a Knoppixy sort of thing for asterisk.
It's CentOS.
You get a nice web interface.
You install it, okay.
Which reduces the flexibility, but you can say, you know, here's a list of my extensions.
I have a stupid question here. Right? Okay. I can understand you can just get an old computer you got in the corner, stick asterisk on it, no problem at all. But don't I need to go and buy loads of magic hardware phone cards that you plug the phones into?
That depends how you want to do it. You can indeed buy cards which will let you plug an ordinary analog telephone line in, or
if your answer is going to be, or you could just use soft phones and talk into your laptop all the time, bug it off.
Well, one of the advantages of asterisk is that it's opened up the telephony market, the VoIP telephony market, a great deal. So you can buy a phone number from providers in the UK and not have to have a physical phone line associated with that in your house or in your office or anything like that, and they will route your call to you wherever you are on the internet your phone system, which is very, very handy. So you don't have to worry about renting the lines, leasing the lines. You don't have to worry about allowing spare capacity. They're doing all of that for you. So that's something that quite a lot of people do.
I mean, that sort of thing, absolutely. I mean, I've got a VoIP line at home, and I have a little VoIP adapter that my phones are plugged into. Mm-hmm. But what I don't understand is, if I wanted an asterisk box, I don't know how to say, I've got four or five phones in my house now.
Regular phones.
I want them to be VoIP. Or I'm prepared to go out and buy some phones, but I don't want to pay £100 per phone.
They're just on the network, aren't they?
But you can't get an ordinary phone and just put it on the network.
No, you buy an adapter for it.
But this do you buy one adapter per phone, or do you plug them all into the asterisk box? Phone,
you can buy what's called an ATA, an analog terminal adapter, which will turn an ordinary regular phone into a VoIP client.
That's what Matt Revelle uses.
I mean, that's what I've got, but I'm not that impressed with mine.
I have to say, at this point, I think you'd be better off really just buying a phone which already speaks SIP, the main VoIP protocol.
I mean, if I buy an ATA, which I have done, I can't see where in that asterisk fits in. I already have an ATA. It lets me use my standard house phones to do VoIP. Mm-hmm. What's the point of having an
but
asterisk?
But you're not the typical asterisk user, are you?
That's perfectly true. If you've got an external provider, probably really asterisk would be better for small companies or organisations.
So like digital receptionists and that kind of thing, isn't it?
So it's people who think we would like to be VoIP across our organisation and we'd like free PBX to do the press one whatever.
Yes, and so it gives you a very easy, free way of doing very complicated phone things, recording people's phone calls, the interactive menus. If you really want to go crazy, you can do voice recognition because you can just hook it into other bits of
software.
People
can get emailed their voicemails and things like that. And one of the cool things about Trixbox, when I used it last, which was admittedly about a year ago, was that it's got built-in Sugar CRM that works with asterisk.
All right.
So when you get a phone call, it brings up that entry in Sugar CRM.
That's pretty cool,
which is awesome.
Last question. How does it stack up against proprietary stuff like Cisco's VoIP offerings?
It depends slightly how you're doing it based on what hardware you need to buy. Because obviously, if you buy a Cisco phone system, they give you a box you put on your wall and a bunch of phones that you plug into it. And that's it as far as hardware is concerned, and you're paying support fees.
£450,000.
You are paying a fairly large amount of money. So if you already had a beefy net connection, you were routing all of your phone calls through a protected section of that that's not going to be destroyed by people watching
goat porn.
Meatspin.com. then you can do away with having to have phone lines, and you can offload that to an external person.
Sorry, just thinking of meatspin.com.
As you do so regularly.
Jono's homepage, by the way.
Every single time I go for a pee in the Log Radio studio, not that I pee in the studio, every single time these buggers change my homepage on the computer to meatspin.com.
Although I have now discovered, thanks to Matt Lee, that I can now change his homepage so it's loads and loads of tabs, all of which are meatspin, which I had no idea
if
was
you haven't case. Seen meatspin, don't go and see it.
Really
that's, don't. That's meatspin.com, meatspin.com.
And lemonparty.com.
Anyway, moving
and
on.
And Tub Girl.
I think that's quite enough about that. End of the show, so it's time for the emails.
Yay! Different the end of the show thing, because it's normally 8. But,
less bald.
Craig?
Not a lot less bald.
Fucking losing the fight, mate.
Yeah.
But yeah, Chris is actually sat in the seat. 8 seat.
I am sat in a seat.
It's 8 seat. he was supposed to be there. Anyway, let's read some emails. Do you want to start?
Okay. I'm starting off here with one from Mark James Talbot, who says, in an earlier episode, you had a long section on the speed of Linux. Linux has gotten slower, not because of the GUI, but because of Python and the likes. Scripting languages add a massive load onto machines that is really not necessary for a production system. This has always been the case with Unix, but normally this has been because they have been custom scripts, but in a GUI environment, they cause much higher load.
So basically, people who write software should be elite hackers.
Yeah, let's write it in fucking binary, shall we? That's a great idea.
Sound like what's his name? The pillar keeps ranting about Windows. Steve Gibson.
Bulmer.
Who thinks that you should write everything in assembler.
Mm.
And I could sort of see his point. You write a program in assembly language, it's like 8K and it does everything, and it's really good, but there's like 9 guys in the world who write it.
Life's too short. Next email from Russell Phillips, who is from Russ and Jen fame. The subject is Mars bar wrappers. In the last episode,
I don't want to hear this.
In the last episode, 8 said he wanted more pregnancies. We figured that we had a duty as the official Lug Radio married couple to do so as instructors. So we'd like to let you know that Jen is pregnant. So congratulations,
hey!
Jen.
Hey!
So round of applause for Jen, Russ and Jen.
Congratulations, Russ and Jen.
Yep.
Good one.
So yeah, well,
congratulations, Jen.
Yeah, Russ, you didn't do much work, to be honest.
Might not have done any work. We don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, we've been around there a few times, haven't we?
Cat and Dave, your rivals for the official Lug Radio Married couple. We're looking at you now.
Yep. So get
forget about the dogs. Get banging.
Lug Radio causes pregnancy. Great. So next up,
right? Next email. One from Katie GB, who's bollocking us about, or bollocking me specifically, actually, about...
Wow, imagine my
about,
surprise.
About progressive enhancement in web applications.
Oh, we're not onto this again.
And she says, first, what you said about Ajax software not being usable by disabled people was one of the dumbest things I've heard any of you say. That completely underestimates our abilities to adjust and use the net as it progresses. If we can deal with progressive disabilities, trust me, we're handling Web 2.0 just fine, and that it ignores how advanced assistive software and hardware are. People like Derek Featherstone and James Edwards would love, I'm being really serious now, would love to hear from you. Because as far as we're concerned, they're accessibility people working hard on making Ajax applications accessible. So they'd really, really like to hear your opinion.
Just on a related note,
Derek Featherstone is a good guy to talk to about this, and Joe Clark. If you Google for them, they'd really, really be interested in your opinions on this.
On a related note,
thank you for letting us know.
Henrik Nielsen Ommer, who's an accessibility guy who's been to Lug Radio Live for the last couple of years, and he apparently him and his team have been working on accessibility for Beryl and Compass, which is quite cool because you wouldn't expect that kind of stuff to be accessible.
No, exactly. So I'm quite prepared to say that I'm basically going on the opinions of people I know in the web accessibility community who say there's still a long way to go with this stuff. But if you think not, then great. Please tell us more about it.
Matthew Lee. I have an email here from Adam Thaler. Who says...
Is he a sailor?
He doesn't say he's a sailor.
Hello, sailor.
Hello, sailor.
Yeah, he's sailing with a lisp. Hello, sailor. Don't carry on.
It says, time for a small kicking. Okay, you beg for more emails, so here's one about giving you all a kicking. You're all wrong.
Is that it?
No. Okay. I'm just letting it sink in for a second. You are all wrong.
Okay.
In the last episode, you talked about how Steve Jobs hates DRM. If you have been paying any attention, you'd see that the only reason he made a public statement against DRM is because Apple is being sued over monopolistic practices with the iPod. Blah, blah, blah. Apple has enough muscle in the music industry to do away with DRM overnight if it wanted to, but they don't want to because it would mean music bought on iTunes could be played on hardware that wasn't sold by them.
Ah, interesting.
So,
fair enough.
EMI didn't happen.
Hey, I thought the EMI thing did happen.
Oh, it did happen, yeah. So you can't be all wrong.
He's always right.
Adam's talking bollocks.
He's pointing, Matt's point there, in case you're new to sarcasm.
Sorry. Sorry. I wasn't actually listening. Christoph.
Chris P. Ravel.
Chris P. Ravel.
Okay, I have an email here from...
Crispy Ravel.
Crispy.
You'd be Chris P. Bacon.
You know, I've never fucking heard that before.
Have you not?
No.
Say it again.
No, actually, in case you're new to sarcasm.
So yeah, I've got an email here from Chris Proctor, who suggests that we should go back in time to the late 80s and warn the BSD 4.4 people they're about to get sued, so that Linux doesn't have to exist, and we'd be 15 years ahead of where we are. And also, we could go around to Jono's house when he was a child and introduce him to some real music.
Hey! Chris Proctor, you are a hero to many people.
And if I could just quickly name check Aidan Delaney, who also mailed in, because he was one of my lecturers at university.
Really?
Yeah. Excellent. But I'm not going to tell you what he said.
He's a repeated radio listener.
Really?
Yeah. I like the way you name check him for that, but don't read his email because he's boring.
It wasn't a very good lecturer. Fuck you.
You struggle over it. What's wrong with that?
Did he fail you or something?
No.
Third.
Aidan Delaney, remember when you said I'd never amount to anything in the world of software? Fuck you. I work for Canonical.
I'm not saying that at all.
I think that's extremely mean. And this man set you on your path, and look what you do to him. Jono, read the email.
We've had an email from Matthew P. Gates. He actually sent us another email, a long email about OpenClipArt and app integration, which I'm not going to read out, because this is much more interesting. He says, almost forgot. He said, I forgot to wish Jono luck in defeating his venereal disease, which is a vicious rumour spread by Christian bastard Kalaga Commando Shallow. An acquaintance of mine was once suffering with something which was pleasantly soothed by applying natural yogurt. He lived in a shared house with thieving bastard housemates and was most amused to find that the pot of salve left in the fridge was nearly empty the day after he dunked his membrane in it. That's the story anyway. I don't believe a word of it. Thanks very much.
Oh, that's harsh. But, you know...
harsh but fair.
Don't steal yogurt. Anyone here from... Genuinely, are you ready? Matthew P. Thomas.
Yeah. No way. An actual P.
MPT, the hero.
An actual Matthew P. Thomas, who says if he could go back in time to change one thing about Linux, he'd make the EXT file system case-preserving but case-insensitive, like Windows and Mac OS.
That's just the kind of clever, wise bullshit that he has to come out with. That guy's too clever.
Moving on.
Huge amount of respect for him and his 3 feet tall
MPT
personality.
MPT is indeed a legend.
I have one here from Freddie Ruddick, who says, you rock. Hey guys, been listening for a while now.
Thank you.
Recommended by the nice people at Ubuntu UK.
Oh, okay. They're a very nice bunch of people.
Yeah,
is
very
that
nice people.
Alan Pope and that
Popey
crew.
And, yeah, Popey Mr. Ben and that lot.
Nick Butler, that loudmouth bastard. And Alan Cox.
Nice one, nice one, Popey. Now he's listening to us again.
Says a quick question. In series 4, episode 15, it was mentioned that in an episode of the Linux Action Show, the opinion was given that Bert and Ernie comment didn't matter, and it was from Britain. What episode was this? Let's have a listen, Freddie. And he says, Frederific on Freenode.
Frederific. What a great name.
Frederific, that's cool.
What was this bullshit about Bert and Ernie? I know what we said, but what was he asking?
Which episode was that in?
Dunno.
Yeah.
It was a couple of episodes ago where I think Adam Sweet said that he emailed the Linux Action Show and said that they sounded like Burton.
Hey, Bert. Did they read it out? Did they actually read out the comment or not?
I don't know. Apparently they weren't particularly happy with that stuff. I met someone the other day who looked like Bert or Ernie. I don't know which one it was, though.
Was it the tall yellow one?
The one with the yellow thing. Yeah, it was Bert. Sure. Yeah. He didn't like that
He's
comment.
He's evil.
Bert is evil. He's got rapist eyebrows.
Right. What the hell are eyebrows to rapist?
Chris,
Bert's eyebrows.
Read an email.
I did my two emails already. Do you want another?
Okay.
I've got one.
I've got
continuing around in the circle.
I've got a couple.
Competition. This comes from Ken Fallon, who gave us a bollocking once about the silly Irish impressions. Yeah. So, hello, my name's Ken Fallon.
Leave him alone.
Be sure.
Hello, Low Radio lad. First, no mention of Jesus Begorra or any silly Irish accent.
No Irish accent.
Now on to the entry for the competition, which we referred to, which we didn't really big up enough.
No, and we're going to. Yeah. So far, Ken's in both the winning and the losing position in this competition.
Ken, we had a competition which was someone...
Yeah, see, that was clever there, wasn't it?
That was very good.
It happens occasionally. Sorry, I just had a stroke. on the last episode, we talked about a competition where people would have a Linux distribution or their laptop or something as high up as possible. So Ken... Ken says, I'm sending you in a picture of me and my laptop running Debian SID. At first glance, it may not appear all that high, but remember that I live in the Netherlands and the altitude shown is actually 3 meters above sea level.
Isn't he standing on a slide?
He's standing on a fucking plastic slide in his garden.
Right, okay, people, you could surely do better than this.
On the Department of Defense about to send a Linux machine into space.
Right. They've got to send us a picture of it, though, otherwise it doesn't
win.
Right, but yeah, so how high is your Linux competition?
How high can you get with Linux, is what it is. Now, Zali is going to be like...
Sitting there with a reefer the size of... It's always a fucking roll of carpet going, oh, it's fantastic. Send a picture of this.
I'm only joking. Zaddy would do no such thing.
Absolutely not.
I work at least 27 floors above sea level. Does that count?
Well, in that case, absolutely. Take a picture of your Linux high up and send it to us. We want to see...
That's a great point, Milbank.
Pictures of your Linux high up in the air... And you've got to do better than Ken, who's in the Netherlands and standing on a slide, which is pathetic.
So his net altitude must be about zero, really.
Go upstairs, surely.
And the competition would be better than that.
The competition is called Getting High with Linux. You make your own interpretation of that.
So, yeah,
someone's smoking a Linux manual.
Send us a picture of yourselves getting high with Linux, and there are prizes.
There are prizes. Very cool prizes.
What
there
are the prizes?
I'm not telling you.
It's a secret.
Is that because you don't know?
Well, possibly. Okay, new competition. It's called Prizes for the Competition. If you've got some prizes you'd like to send us and have us pimp your thing, tell us. I mean, we do have some prizes, but if anyone would like to donate anything else to give away as a prize, we're always interested.
Yeah,
that's a very good idea.
Yeah.
Although you have to send it to me, because last time people sent stuff to Jono, he pugged away some of the prizes.
There's fucking no such thing.
Yes, you
admittedly, I wanted to steal that Minnie Mouse. And not funnily, Minnie Mouse, you know.
And funnily enough, there was no Minnie Mouse when we came back to the park.
No, there was a Minnie Mouse. I got a rampant bollocking because I wanted to replace...
We got donated some prizes for a competition, and O. Bacon pugged away some of the prizes in his own drawer.
I did not pug away any prizes.
Thieving.
Actually, I've got that box of Microsoft software we could give away.
Yeah.
Don't give that away.
I've got one of those as well, actually.
Burn it.
Have you not done anything with it?
No.
Ravel has.
Is he?
Ravel did something with it.
Ooh.
What did he do with it?
I don't know. I don't know what he did with it, but I'm sure if you go to eBay.co.uk, you can find out.
I must admit, that was an interesting... Just talk about that slightly. When we went down to Microsoft to talk to them about free software and whatnot.
And how much they
gave. They gave all of us a big box of Microsoft software.
About a grand's worth of software.
There's Vista and Office and stuff like that in there. Now, I didn't want to... we didn't get the chance. We got sent it afterwards. So if they'd just given it, I'd have said no thanks. But I don't want to give it to people because that encourages them to use Windows, which is a crap idea. But equally, I don't want to just chuck it away because it's a genuinely valuable thing. I'd feel really cheap if they gave me a thing and I just binned it.
Make some art out of it.
And I must confess, I did give my wife the Microsoft Office USB key ring that they gave us.
Ack, you know what we're gonna do? It's like break my iPod or whatever it's called.
Let's do that.
We got two boxes of the stuff.
Have you seen the video? The installing Vista video on YouTube.
No.
This guy gets a Vista DVD and he goes, "I'm now gonna try." I tried to get this to install on my laptop and it wouldn't install. So now I'm gonna try installing on this other machine I've got. And he's got a paper shredder and he feeds the DVD into it.
The guy's got
and this thing's going.
The guy is just absolute comedy gold.
And he goes, "Oh, see, it's installed now. It was wicked."
Let's do that. Let's do that.
Surely you can apply for a refund from Microsoft if you don't agree with the license conditions. You can just get the money from Microsoft.
Well, yeah, but I'd feel really cheap doing that. They gave me a present,
and then
I try and exchange it for money. This is why you're not invited to talk to Microsoft.
There are other reasons as well.
Matt@fsf.org.
Matt L.
But anyway, I have
The makers of hoverboards.
Yes. Let's not go there fucking again.
Hoverboards.
Don't believe the lies, children.
Don't believe the lies.
That's the prize you can win.
Email from John Meadows in Toronto, who says, "A comment on convincing people to use Linux with the faster and more secure and more stable argument. Apparently we missed the point. Because users don't see themselves as using an operating system, but rather as using applications. They think of themselves as a Microsoft Office user rather than a Windows
Which
user.
Which I think is a reasonable point.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
So we're done with email.
Strong applications will make or break the widespread adoption of Linux on the desktop.
Okay. Good stuff. So we're done.
Okay. Thank you very much, our special studio guest.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Incidentally, before...
Chris P. Ravel.
Thank you. Chris P. Ravel and Matt P. Bradshaw.
Thank you.
On the next show... I'm looking at Ack because I'm going to say this, and he may look at me as if to say, "You shouldn't have said that."
We're going to announce the
schedule for the Radio Live.
We are. We pretty much. If you're out there and you're a speaker at Lug Radio Live, we will have already contacted you, which means that you probably haven't got back to me with a talk title yet, you idle bastards.
When is Lug Radio
Christian
Live?
Frederick Kalaga Schaller, I'm looking at you here.
Seventh and the and Nat Friedman and Chris DeBona, we're looking at you as well.
And Aaron Saigo.
Tiny, tiny Aaron. angry little shite that he is.
So you people, all of you who I've pinged recently, Jerv as well, actually, bastard. Yeah, no.
Daniel
tiny,
James.
Tiny Jerv.
Tiny, tiny, tiny yep. Jerv.
We will be chasing our the remaining few speakers who haven't got back to us yet. Over the next couple of weeks, and then in the next show we will be able to say the schedule is out.
It's on the 7th and the 8th of July, answering Matt's question.
So where is it?
It's in Wolverhampton.
In Wolverhampton.
It's at the Lighthouse.
How do I find out more information about
you
this?
Can go to lugradio.org/live. So it's going to be you're going to see a lot more stuff kicking off about Lug Radio, because the main thing we've been concentrating on recently is the speakers. So you're going to hear a lot more about it over the next coming months.
One of the things that we're going to be doing fairly soon is recruiting for the crew.
Yes.
And we've already had quite a few people. All you people who sent an email in show at lugradio.org saying we'd like to be in the crew. We have got your emails, promise. We just haven't contacted you yet.
We will be in touch over the next week.
We will do. But if you want to be part of the crew, it means you get in for free, but it means you do have to carry a lot of boxes and act like our monkey all the time.
But you will get to wear a cool t-shirt.
You will get to wear a cool t-shirt. It's a very cherished position. Really, really it is.
What happens is you get to fill up our beer when we run out, and we get to slap you in the face occasionally when we want to feel
exactly.
superior.
Exactly. You know, fan us and peel us grapes and shit.
Yeah. So if you want to be Jono's gimp boy, right in.
I'm sure everybody's going
to
be
lugradio.org/live. Send us emails to show@lugradio.org.
yep, go to the forums, forums.lugradio.org.
yep,
and yeah, definitely send us emails, and also send us in little audio clips. A guy sent us in an audio clip just expressing an opinion about something, and the problem was that it was like 2.5 minutes. Send us in clips of something you want to say, even if it's wacky or something you want to talk about, but keep it less than 30 seconds. If we get something interesting, we'll stick it in the show.
We will. If we get a lot of these, we'll try and drum up a voicemail number again.
Yeah.
And so email us. But so, yes.
Good stuff. Okay. Thanks, guys, for coming on the show.
You've
been very entertaining. Thanks, Matt, for the vicious beating that you got earlier on and standing up.
That's okay.
You're a hero to free software.
Thank you for defending the Free Software Foundation or the GNU project or the GNU operating system
or GNU.org
or whatever the hell different.
And now you can GNU/fuck off.
Yeah, GNU, thanks, Jono.
Okay, GNU/goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Since we gave Matt a bit of a beating early, we thought we might give him a bit more of a chance to, you know, speak his mind on a few other points. So, Matt, if you had one statement that boiled down your philosophy, what would it be?
I hate freedom.
Okay. So Matt, what do you think of the Microsoft's brand new operating system?
Windows Vista. Great.
So now, I mean, you do a lot of work with Richard Stallman, obviously, leader of the FSF and so on. So do you want to tell us, we're really into the inside
gen. Yeah, definitely, yeah.
What do you and RMS get up to?
Richard Stallman fucking sucks. My balls.
So Matt, you've been a notable criticiser of Ubuntu's stance on freedom.
You have.
What do you think the biggest mistake has been in the Ubuntu project?
Mark Shuttleworth pointlessly hired Chris Jones for meatspin.com.
Wow, interesting answers.
Well, no, absolutely. Thanks very much, Matt Lee. And if you want to be part of this kind of thing, send your money to GNU.org.
Thanks very much, Matt Lee.